Thanks for coming today. I'll be discussing how we're working on engaging environmental health labs to establish a model for sustainability. I'm a researcher in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences. We received funding from the University of Washington at the beginning of the year to conduct an assessment and identify areas of improvement for our labs in regards to sustainability. And we're working with the University of Washington Green Labs program on this project. So I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I'll be providing some context for the project, then give a brief overview of the Green Lab certification program, and then discuss some of our efforts to transition to safer and greener chemicals, and then go over lessons learned and next steps. So starting out with some context for the project. There's two main goals. So the first one is to facilitate the participation of our departmental labs, which I'll refer to as DEOHS, in the University of Washington Green Lab Certification Program, and focusing on three areas to improve our sustainability metrics on chemical use, solid waste that we generate, and the energy consumption. And then two is to provide feedback to the Green Labs program based on our experience. It's a new program, and they're looking for feedback for their next iteration. For this talk, I'll just be focusing on some of our efforts as far as the chemical use. Right, so we have 20 labs. There's 8 toxicology labs. They study the effect of toxicants on health using animal models and cell and tissue culture. On the top right, it's an image of some tissue culture work. There's 5 industrial hygiene exposure sciences labs that conduct a lot of sampling, 3 microbiology labs, 1 genetics lab, and 2 chemistry labs, so it's quite diverse. Our mission statement is to study how environmental factors can harm human health and how to identify, prevent, and control their effects. Our goal through research, teaching, and service is prevention and protection. Yet many of our own practices haven't been evaluated, and so I feel like we have the expertise and the capability to be a good example and to provide a model for other researchers and also for industry. So I think it's important to define sustainability in the context of this project. So sustainability is often defined as having 3 pillars, the economic, environment, and social equity pillars. I think from what I've been learning in the past year from a research perspective, the economic perspective is very important. So high quality research needs to be generated and maintained in order for labs to maintain competitive for funds. And also the methods that are proposed need to be affordable and within grant budgets. From the University of Washington Green Labs program perspective, they're interested in minimizing global warming pollution and waste, and also reducing or eliminating the use of chemicals of concern. And then from EHS and also lab perspectives, lab personnel safety is important. And then also I think something that's out of the scope of this project but worth bringing up is that the research that is conducted, the purpose of the research should be such that it does benefit public health, and the impact of the research is greater than the negative impact that is caused by conducting the research. So, and I guess I think all of these three areas need to convene in order for real sustainability to happen. So next I want to go over the Green Lab Certification Program. So as an initial engagement step, we asked all of the 20 labs to complete a certification application, and this was developed by the University of Washington Green Labs program. There's 7 sections and on different lab sustainability topics, and this is a snapshot of one of the sections. And there's a 3 levels of certification that can be achieved. So these are the results. On the left are the 7 different sections that are on the application. In the middle column are the results from our department. So these are what I'm considering the baseline results. We asked labs to complete this application before making any changes, and that's in contrast to the right column, which are all university labs that decided to apply, excluding ours, and they've looked at the application, made changes, and then applied. So you can see our scores are are lower, but I think that just is telling that we can make, there's opportunities to make some easy changes and increase our scores. But there's also, I just wanted to point out, for communication and education, our score was quite low, and just wanted to acknowledge that the environmental health labs are, you know, we're conducting research that's informing a lot of the sustainability efforts, but we're not talking about how to integrate those topics into our research itself. So how can we take it to the next level? I guess is where this project comes in. Seven of our labs were certified at the lowest level, the bronze level. So we are making some efforts. And let me skip this slide. So some of the barriers we identified from our from asking the labs to complete the application as well as follow-up interviews we had are we categorize them into six different categories, and I'll just go through them and provide an example or description for each one. So time to develop new methods and protocols is a barrier, and also the cost of funding personnel time, the cost of new instrumentation and more expensive chemicals is prohibitive, and expenses are incurred by labs, but cost savings will go to the university in many cases, so there's less chemical hazardous waste generated. The university as a whole gets that cost, but it doesn't trickle down to the labs. Chemical selection is often based on performance. There's not health and safety criteria involved in the chemical selection. And approved protocols that are used by the labs for by the analytical labs often use hazardous chemicals. There's not really a cohesive departmental effort at this time, which is needed, I think, to gain momentum for change to occur. And there's physical barriers. Our labs are located in two buildings, which is creates some barriers for sharing. And communication, like I mentioned before. There's some behavioral barriers, so preferences for methods, products, or chemicals, and lab personnel don't want to switch because it takes a long time to get something to work in the first place in some cases. Perceptions that only small amounts of chemicals are being used, so the impact is not significant, and that all feasible changes have been made, so nothing more can be done. And also, there are some available resources, but they're not easily accessible for labs, and there's a lot of data gaps in chemical hazard information. Right, so with that, I wanted to discuss a few of our efforts to transition to safer and greener chemicals and how we've tried to overcome these barriers. So we're using this process framework called it's OSHA's Transitioning to Safer Chemicals Toolkit. It's a pretty straightforward process for you. Engage your stakeholders, identify or inventory and prioritize your chemicals, identify alternatives, assess and compare, select an alternative, do some testing and evaluation. And the chemical assessment tools we're using, well, we're primarily using the Washington State Department of Ecology Quick Chemical Assessment Tool, and that's basically a simplified version of the green screen for safer chemicals, which some of you may have heard of. I think it's a little more well-known. And I'll go over the QCAT method in just a moment. First, I want to provide a snapshot of chemicals that are used in the department. So we looked at several sources to try and get an idea of what's being used and what are the high-volume chemicals. We found over 2,900 different chemicals. In 2013, our purchases were somewhere between 600 and 700,000. About 73% of our chemical purchases are in the form of these assays and kits, and so they're made for specific processes, and each one has different chemical components. Those are generally not captured by the chemical inventories. We looked at 5 years of chemical hazardous waste data. About 2,400 pounds are generated annually, and these are the top 10 chemicals in the hazardous waste data. So most of them are solvents. So one resource that we can provide with the labs is a solvent selection guide. So that's these There are several solvent selection guides available and developed mostly by the pharmaceutical industry, but they have rankings of different classes of solvent by different types of hazards. So at least it gives researchers an idea of the hazards in terms of environmental and human health effects. We also asked labs what some of their chemicals of concern were, and one that was mentioned was thidium bromide. Thidium bromide is a nucleic acid stain used in molecular biology. A lot of labs use it for their DNA analysis, and it's called an intercalating agent because it, so here's your DNA double helix, and it, the thidium bromide molecule lays flat with it, in between the base pairs of the DNA, so it can create a mutagenic effect. So it has a reputation as a strong mutagen, which is why labs are concerned with its use. I want to walk you through this slide. It's a little confusing. So we went through and used a QCAT methodology to assess the thidium bromide. And so at the top here, so the QCAT assigns a chemical a grade from A being preferable and F being avoid. And it does that based on these, so there's 9 hazard criteria, so different human health endpoints. Carcinogenicity, mutagenicity, reproductive and developmental toxicity, endocrine disruption, acute mammalian and acute aquatic toxicity, and persistence in bioaccumulation. And so there's different hazard levels assigned to each of those criteria, and the levels are assigned by looking at different authoritative, what they call authoritative sources, so these EPA sources, European Union REACH, the GHS, the Globally Harmonized System for Classifying and Labeling Chemicals. So many different sources are involved in assigning these levels. And then there's a scoring algorithm and then a grade. A grade is assigned. So there's an initial grade and then a final grade that that's assigned if there's a lot of data gaps. So these DGs are data gaps. So if there's not enough information on a chemical to assign a hazard level, it's assigned a data gap for that level. So thidium bromide was assigned an avoid grade mostly because of its very high persistence in the environment and its acute mammalian toxicity. So we looked at 2 different alternatives to thidium bromide. We looked at one called CyberSafe and one called Gel Red. And they both of them in their product descriptions make claims of being safer than thidium bromide. So we worked with the Department of Ecology and a toxicology consulting firm called Tox Services they do a lot of chemical hazard assessments. And we took a closer look at CyberSafe, and the toxicologist working on it called it Cyber Somewhat Safe. We were hoping to have this easy solution and be able to provide labs with this recommendation that CyberSafe was the definite choice to make, but it ends up that we're not able to do that. It ends up with the same end grade, mostly based on its persistence and acute aquatic toxicity. But what we can do is provide labs with this information and let them make a more informed decision. And we're also hoping we're going to send the full report to the manufacturer in hopes that they have more information they can disclose or would be willing to. Another chemical of concern that was brought up by our environmental health lab was carbon disulfide. So it's a solvent used to desorb volatile organic compounds from charcoal sorbent tubes used in air sampling. And it's highly flammable and has acute mammalian toxicity. So it's an occupational hazard in the labs. We did the QCAT assessment. Just want to point out it's also reproductive and developmental toxic and highly persistent in the environment. So after we did this, we did a literature review and identified some potential methods that would allow us to not use carbon disulfide in the analysis process. And one of those is this process called thermal desorption. And thermal desorption eliminates the use of all solvents. So it's on the industrial hygiene hierarchy of controls. is far superior because you're not using any solvents. The tubes are reusable, there's better sensitivity, and it has demonstrated success in literature. It may not be appropriate for all settings or all sampling, as it's more prone to contamination and requires training and development of protocols. And there's not many analytical methods that use thermal desorption tubes. So this is a case where we're working with both the Environmental Health Lab on the analysis part, and we're also working with one of the Exposure Sciences Labs on the sampling part to try and come up with a new method to eliminate the use of carbon disulfide. So now I want to go over lessons learned and next steps. Communication is very important, not only between the labs, but with our project trying to communicate with the labs. I think that our approach could have been better at the beginning, and in general, labs want to remain autonomous and don't want somebody coming in to tell them what to do, and I think maybe we were perceived as that, and we were trying to be more collaborative. So it was a lesson learned on our part. Difficult to make informed decisions because of data gaps. There's not a lot of information available to make informed decisions. We found this not only with the chemicals, but with trying to make good decisions about which consumables were the more sustainable consumables. Decisions are not always straightforward or obvious. And efforts need to be tailored toward lab priorities. So we need to think about both the maintaining high quality research, but also how can we do it with the least impact possible. And labs are in the best position to identify chemicals of concern in the academic setting. We try to go through this whole process of inventory and prioritizing, but there's so many different processes going on, so many chemicals used for different purposes that it was very difficult. I think in an industrial setting, it would be easier to go in more of the inventory prioritization process. And then focusing on some of the common lab processes, such as the DNA analysis with ethidium bromide, may be a more successful approach for us. And change needs to occur at multiple levels. So when I've been thinking about change and addressing barriers to safer and greener chemical adoption, I like to think of it in terms of this. This is the socio-ecological model for prevention. So I've just put in some recommendations that I think, some are more or less practical, but at an individual level, providing resources and time for lab staff, lab researchers to try and come up with new methods in a interpersonal, which I'm equating to a departmental level, a more cohesive effort in our department to bring our labs together for this effort. From an organizational point of view, from a University of Washington point of view, like integrating green chemistry into lab safety, into the lab safety program would be probably very helpful. Right now, we're mostly focusing on PPE as far as the lab safety initiative, and I think we need to move up higher up the hierarchy and how can we eliminate some of these chemicals and how can we find safer substitutes. And then from the community standpoint, making hazard assessments more of the standard or norm in research and industry. And then from a public policy, phasing out of high hazard chemicals, which I know is kind of controversial. People complain about it, but I think, usually find a different way when they have to. And I found that in this project, I've had to achieve a balance between flying blind, reading product descriptions and making decisions based on that. I felt like I wasn't informed, and I was just going based on some sort of greenwash materials versus looking in and digging into the literature, and I felt like I was hitting this analysis paralysis end where I could keep looking for something and I wouldn't find anything, but I would find something kind of like it, and I just, it was very hard to make progress in that way too. So achieving a balance between those, I think, is important. So next steps, we're going to give recommendations to the Green Labs program based on our experience, compile some resources for the departmental labs, which I've talked about. We'll ask labs to apply for certification again this winter in hopes that the scores go up, and then provide our department with a sustainability roadmap as well as recommendations to the university. And acknowledgments, the labs, the various departments on campus that we've been working with, the Washington State Department of Ecology, and my family. And I guess in response to the question that was asked earlier, like, why are we all here? I think the reason I'm here is because my family, my daughter, you know, I want her to be able to grow up in a clean environment and not have to worry about, you know, I guess the relics of our generation. So that's why I'm here, and I think this is important. And does anyone have questions? Yeah, right now it's all in progress. You know, we'll have a final report that, you know, I can provide. So I'm not sure what the other deliverables will look like quite yet. But yeah, you can send me an email so I can have your contact information. There and there. Yeah.
I mean, I would love to get rid of certain chemicals in my laboratory, but in order for us to have certification and to do certain types of work, we have to use that. And it seems like the last person to recognize the chemicals are hazardous is the federal government as far as getting those chemicals out of the lab.
Yeah, I agree. I had a conversation with somebody from NIOSH, and they, when I brought that up, they said that, you know, labs can switch if they can demonstrate that the other method that they choose to use is this, you know, gives the same results. But yeah, I mean, it goes back to the barriers, the time and the money, and et cetera. So I agree, and that is something that we're also working on. So. Yeah, I'm not sure how fast any of those efforts would move, knowing how the government works. So, I mean, it seems like it has to be something where we're going to have to take initiative as well and to make some progress and not be too little too late.